You have the official title of this presentation, which is supposed to be Understanding Earth History, the Fossil Record. That probably is, I don't know, too close, whatever. But the alternative title is Old Rock, Dead Stuff, Who Cares? And that's pretty much the way a lot of people feel about the information that I'm going to share with you. That we're just dealing with a bunch of old rocks and all these fossils and dead things, and it's not all that important in our understanding of what's going on in the world. But there are a lot of issues that we need to address. And one is our Earth itself. One of the questions that often comes up is, well, how old is the Earth? How old is the rock? When you look at science, science will tell you that it's 4.5 billion years old, although there isn't any rock that's really that old. They claim that they have rock that's 3.9 billion years old. And there are good scientific arguments for rock being of that age, but those arguments also apply to the rock within the geologic column itself where we find fossils. And so I tend to waffle on whether or not the rock is old or young, because there are also strong theological arguments for young rock. So don't push me either way, because if you start arguing from one position, I tend to take the other. And I haven't resolved this to my own satisfaction, my own comfort. This is one of those areas of conflict still in my life, where it would be nice to resolve this with some quick, easy answer, but it doesn't seem to be a quick, easy answer. And my tendency is to lean toward the biblical understanding, simply because of the confidence that I have in God's Word and the reliability of that. But when it comes to life, I'm definitely a young life person. Life is recent. We're going to look at the geologic column. Now, the geologic column itself is kind of an amalgamation. It's an integration of information from all over the world. There are numerous places, in fact, in the world where you have all of the periods represented, stacked one on top of the other. But there is no truly complete sequence of the geologic column that I know of anywhere in the world. There's always material missing, within those periods. So we're divided up into the large sections, the eras, then the periods, and then those are subdivided into epochs. This basically is the geologic column itself. On the left-hand side, you see the eras there. Coming from the base up, geologists tend to work from the base up. Unless they're petroleum geologists, then they work from the top down. But typically, when we're an outcrop, we work from the base. And we begin with the Precambrian. That's below the Cambrian. If you look over in the periods, that's the lowest unit within the Paleozoic. And in the Precambrian, we have upper, middle, and lower. And we have the time scale, which, if you check that little asterisk up there, it says represents millions of years, not endorsed by the Geoscience Research Institute. I don't endorse it either. Above the Precambrian, we have the Paleozoic, then the Mesozoic, and the Cenozoic above that. And as we look at the periods, we're going to be going up through these periods. And then when we get into the Cenozoic, we'll even look at some of the epochs. I realized that over in the epochs for the Mesozoic and Paleozoic, it says upper, middle, and lower. There are a multitude of epochs that are described and named in the geologic column. The Precambrian, we're going to start off looking at Archean and Proterozoic. That's the two major divisions in the Precambrian. And the creation issues here, basically, all are focusing around, where did life come from? All right. For a long time, we have looked at this question, and some believe that it is through spontaneous generation, life coming from non-living material. And so there was a primordial soup more than 3 billion years ago. Two amino acids drift together. 6 seconds later, they drift apart. And more than 400 million years later, two amino acids drift together. That view has been held for a long time, that somehow there was a primordial soup in which amino acids did drift together and life began. What is interesting, there are two aspects of this that are interesting. One is there are scientists that know that the primordial soup idea does not work, and so they have moved toward clay minerals, and they want to use that medium for the origin of life. But what is even more interesting is the fact that many of us you know, through the years, you think about the odds of this happening, they just seem absolutely impossible. You've just got, it's like one in a gazillion chances that life would originate like this. But if you look at it from the perspective of the evolutionist, they are looking at it and saying, there are millions of worlds out there, and if you're a Star Trek fan, there are millions of M-class planets out there where these amino acids could be drifting around in primordial soups, and if that's true, then this coming together, these few seconds, are occurring almost continuously through the eons of time. And that's the way they look at it. So they don't have these gigantic odds against the origin of life. And what's interesting is the Seventh-day Adventists, we believe in other worlds as well. We believe that there is life elsewhere in the universe. And so we're probably, you know, kind of in an odd situation there as we try to discuss this. Other evangelicals are going to say, no, no, we're really the only ones here. Because basically they believe that the whole universe, many of them believe the whole universe was created 6,000 years ago. All right, we want to look for a minute at the Archean microorganisms. These are supposedly the earliest life forms. These are basically bacteria. And I was very fortunate in being able to get this series of slides. The man who found these organisms and was doing the research on them, I wrote him and asked him if we could have, you know, a photograph for an article in Geoscience Reports where we were going to make a little report on the appearance of these. And he sent me a whole set of his slides plus the paper. So he was very, very kind. But they look very much like bacteria today. And they come in all shapes and sizes. And they're supposedly 3.5 million years old. And there's a lot of question about that because live bacteria have been found in the Precambrian rocks, modern live bacteria. So you have to wonder, you know, how valid this is. But for those who believe that life originated and developed from microorganisms, this is really solid data with regard to the origin of life. All right, let's take a look at the upper and into the Proterozoic at the Ediacaran fauna. I just want to give you a picture of the fossil record, what it looks like out there in the rock. In looking at the Ediacaran fauna, we have things that they think might have been jellyfish preserved. These are very soft. This one, some have called it a jellyfish. There, I was at a Geological Society of America meeting about 2-3 years ago, and there was a fellow, and he showed this particular fossil, and he was suggesting that these were lichens, and he had a whole series of different fossils that he presented that had previously been discussed as jellyfish or various types of organisms, and he thought that it was lichens, and everyone was laughing. It was a big joke, and he was making jokes about it. You know, use your imagination, can't you tell? And it was really hysterical, and everyone had a marvelous time. And within the year, a paper came out suggesting seriously that these were lichens, fossil lichens. At any rate, no one's really too clear on what the Ediacaran fauna actually represent. They are very, very different from the microorganisms which we have seen before, and we won't really see them again. In the record, this is some type of segmented worm. And again, something that has a jellyfish type of appearance. And then we move into the Cambrian. Now, in the Cambrian, things change, and they change very rapidly. In the Cambrian, we have what's called the Cambrian explosion, the sudden appearance of life. In the upper Cambrian, all of the basic phyla, all of the phyla have a representative in the upper Cambrian, before the end of the Cambrian. Now that is really fantastic. There is even a report of a chordate in the upper Cambrian. Now that may or may not be true. That's fairly recent, but so far it seems to be holding its ground. So if that's true, we're getting all of the basic kinds in the record at the same time, unrelated to what we have seen in the Ediacaran fauna, unrelated to what we have seen as far as the bacteria are concerned. These are all the major phyla. And so we have things like this, Anomalocaris, and we have Anotoya here. It's like a little segmented type of worm. And, of course, the trilobites. unusual animals, jointed bodies. The eyes had calcite lenses, much like insects, faceted, and their appendages, their legs were jointed. So we're talking about an organism that suddenly appears in the record that is highly developed and highly specialized. And this is all a part of that Cambrian explosion. In the Ordovician, I'm going to remind you that we don't just have the marine fauna suddenly appearing in the record and the flora, but also we have things happening with regard to the continents themselves. Now, if you look, the white part outlines the actual continent today and what, you know, and you can see everything's kind of split up and moved around. This doesn't look like the Pangaea picture. This is what is postulated for that period known as the Ordovician. And the green shows you all of the Ordovician deposits worldwide, and they're all marine. Okay? So the white stuff isn't out there. The green stuff is all marine, and the red stuff is the only known terrestrial material. Now, they call it terrestrial because it has no fossils. Whether that means that it's some kind of igneous material, a granite body or something like that, or metamorphic material or sediment, it doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't have fossils, so they assume that it's not marine. All right? And the whole rest of the world is water. And so when we start talking in terms of a flood modeling of what things really look like, it's a real challenge. It's a real challenge because we don't know what the pre-flood world looked like. And we look at this and we believe that we're already within the flood because organisms are dying and being buried catastrophically. In the Silurian, we're going to see the same thing happen. Again, this is going to be the last of the marine beds and the first of the fish appear. And you can see some lateral movement with respect to these continents. Now, here's what's interesting. All the rotation is based on paleomagnetic data, and that's going to depend on how much you believe that data, which is very, very sketchy. And in my opinion, not something I would want to be drawing conclusions on of any kind very firmly. But also, you need to know that longitude is not known. This is the imagination of the geologist. They don't have longitude for any of this. They have latitude, but they don't have longitude. And so, obviously, things have moved, but how much they've moved laterally, we don't know. In the Devonian, we're looking at Age of Fish, and we'll see the old red sandstone. There's a rather large specimen there. We haven't really seen fish like this before. We have the first fish appearing in the Upper Silurian, and now in the Devonian, we have the Age of Fish, where fish are dominant, are the dominant animals. And these are armored fish. The only living armored fish we have today, I believe, are the coelacanths that they found off Madagascar. So this is a very unusual fish that goes extinct, and we don't see it anymore. And then we have the lobe-finned fishes. And this is a mass kill, a mass mortality. When you see something like this, you know that the organisms were buried very rapidly because they were not scavenged. And you also know that they were mineralized very rapidly because they haven't returned to dust, so to speak. The muds in the floor of the ocean, the muds on a floodplain, wherever you are at the bottom of a lake, these muds recycle the nutrients into the system to keep the living organisms going. That's the way the whole world is designed as a result of sin, I believe. And then this is basically what the botanists have been doing. It's in the Devonian that we get some rather extensive Devonian coal beds. They're not nice big commercial beds, so to speak, but we do have Devonian coals. And you'll notice we have these trees with no leaves. That's because we haven't ever found any. You'll notice we have these with no roots. That's because we don't know what they look like. You don't find any evidence of things like fruit or seeds or anything like that. We don't have angiosperms in the record as far as we know. But anything that we don't know about, well, they just don't put in the picture, which I think is good. They're very honest with what they know and what they don't know. This is the Old Red Sandstone, the Devonian Old Red Sandstone, which is first found. It's in Wales, Scotland, in that area. The geologic column itself was first described in England. That's where they began to first put things together. The Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian was worked out in Wales by Sedgwick and Murchison and one of Murchison's students. And then we have the discovery of the Old Red Sandstone. And what happens is you go other places in the world and you see classic deposits that are similar worldwide. And that starts getting really, truly exciting, folks, when you can move from one region to another, one continent to another, and you see deposits that are essentially the same. And they're at the same timeline, according to the geologic community. How can that happen? How do you find such classic localities as that? Then we move into Carboniferous. Here you find the major coal beds, your first winged insects, and the first conifers. And so we have the reconstructions again, and you will notice that there's limited root information, lots of logs, and we're getting a little bit more information as far as the branches of the trees and the vegetation. And this is one of the fossil logs here. You can see the mold there coming up from the hammer on the edge of that. You can see the pattern of the trunk of the tree. And then in the Permian, we have the PT boundary event. At the end of the Permian, as we've talked about, as we've gone up through the column, organisms are appearing. They're dying for the first time, and they continue to die for a period of time, and then they go extinct. And then new organisms appear and begin to die for the first time and continue dying and then go extinct. At the end of the Permian, 96% of the marine organisms that were alive at the start of the Permian are extinct by the end of the Permian. 96% of the marine life is lost. It goes extinct. We have animals like Dimetrodon, which is supposedly one of those links between reptiles and mammals that is talked about, with a big sail on his back, supposedly he had somehow regulated body temperature or whatever. Lots of great ideas, you know, floating around, but actually establishing any kind of real relationship is far more difficult. It's an unusual animal. In the Triassic, you get your first hexacorals. The entire system of coral in the oceans has changed. We had tetracorals before, now we have hexacorals. So something has changed in the marine system, or we've moved into a new marine basin and we're introducing new corals that are being buried. We have red beds throughout the Triassic. We had red beds in the Permian. And evaporite minerals worldwide. It's incredible. And here you have the first dinosaurs. The first dinosaurs, there are about 20 species that appear in four very separate localities worldwide in the Late Carnian, which is at the end of the Triassic. And by the end of the Triassic dinosaurs are dead. This is a Coelophysis, one of the Triassic dinosaurs. And these are fossil logs, part of the Chinle Formation in Arizona, east of Flagstaff in the Chinle Fossil Forest. Dr. Arthur Chadwick and Dr. Leonard Brand went out and did a study on the orientation of the logs, and that was published in Origins. And they determined that there was log orientation. And in fact, these things have been transported. There was evidence that they had been transported and had been oriented during transport. That's very fascinating, you know. That's, to me, I start looking at these deposits and I see one catastrophe after another, because this covers an incredibly broad area. The Chinle Formation is quite large. You see the Chinle there in Arizona, and you go right up in through Utah with the Chinle. And the Chinook conglomerate at the base of that unit covers 100,000 square miles. It's an incredible deposit. And so these are broad, sweeping deposits of terrestrial material. Where do we get environments like that today? They are extremely limited in our world. We have basinal settings today. This is just a general reconstruction of the Triassic landscape. And again, you see, we've lost the tops of a whole lot of trees because they just don't know what they were like. They just have a lot of logs out there. All right, and then we move into the Jurassic, where we have our first birds and the rifting of the Atlantic Ocean. In the Jurassic, we have the Jurassic dinosaurs appear, and then they disappear by the end of the Jurassic. This is Archaeopteryx. It's probably the most famous. This is where people start getting all excited, because this is the link between dinosaurs and birds. This is the organism that has 15 reptilian features and 4 avian features, and obviously is a mixture of character traits. What do you do with this animal? Is it truly the link between dinosaurs and birds? Could it fly? That's a big question. Could it fly? I think most have come to the conclusion it couldn't actually fly, certainly couldn't fly up from the ground. It does not have the keeled sternum, it does not have the wing muscle mass to body muscle mass ratio that's needed for flight in birds. But it is clearly reptilian. And the feathers are fully formed, fully modern flight feathers. It's amazing. They are fully modern. They have the barbules that help shape the feather, give the feather its form. This is an amazing, a very fascinating animal. And it's there in the record. It's in the Solnhofen limestone in Germany. And they have found, I believe there's 7 or 8 specimens now. I thought that Dr. Jim Gibson, the director at Geoscience, said the other day that he thought he'd heard a report there was a 9th even. But these are just phenomenal organisms. Fascinating to look at. We need more of them, actually. It would be fascinating to have more to study, to learn more about them. And then in the Cretaceous, we come to the KT boundary event. That will be the extinction at the end of the Cretaceous, where we lose all of the ammonoids out of the marine system and the dinosaurs go extinct. We gain the first grasses and the angiosperms. And mammals come in very, very strong at the end of the Cretaceous and cross the KT boundary. This is what's amazing. Here we have this incredible, supposedly KT boundary impact event where an asteroid struck the Earth and threw up dust, which circled the Earth globe and shut out the sun and caused, in effect, a deep winter that destroyed plant life and caused all these things to go extinct. And frogs crossed the boundary. And mammals crossed the boundary. And angiosperms crossed the boundary in the grasses. It's incredible what survives and what does not survive and how that impacts on why did the dinosaurs, which are terrestrial-only organisms, and then ammonoids, which are marine-only organisms, go extinct. Totally diverse environments, and they go extinct. So that is a fascinating problem. And here we're looking at the dark bands that you see in there are Cretaceous coals in sandstones that are turbidites. I hope that you saw some information on turbidites last night, talking about these density currents, these dense flows of mud and sand in the water that blanket large regions in a very short period of time. And this is just a picture of Utah during the Cretaceous, during part of the Cretaceous. And there's quite a bit more known about the animals. I mean the plants and the animals as well. These are it's called Stegosaurus. These are part of the dinosaur community. Some of the small dinosaurs. I like to show small dinosaurs so that people begin to realize that not all the dinosaurs were gigantic. That most of them were smaller than a giraffe. And this is a restoration of a skeleton of the Upper Cretaceous multituberculate mesodema, about two-thirds its natural size. Now look at what is real there. You have a little bit of the foot, some leg bones, a little bit of the pelvis, some out of the tail and the back and vertebra and some teeth, a bit of jaw. And most everything else is kind of dotted in. The mammal record is really sad. there's just not a lot that's really well preserved. And I think that one thing that may have contributed to this was as the flood process continued and sediments were being deposited, the minerals that had saturated the waters and were being used for fossilization were gradually being used up and incorporated into the rock, so that as we come into the deposition of these mammals, we're not getting nice preservation. But you will notice that there has been an order in this record, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. In the tertiary, the mammals dominate. At the base of the tertiary, we have that paleogene, or it's called the paleogene. Mammalogists use that term. This is the Paleocene epoch. You get your first primates, your first insectivores, and you have some unusual-looking animals like the Uintatheria here. And then you move into the Eocene, and you have your first rodents and your first proboscideans. And we get a little landscape picture, and many of these plants will look more familiar to you. And then we move into the Oligocene, and we have the three-toed horse. This is some fossil wood from the Oligocene. One little thing on the horses, that would be in the Miocene. Sorry. We'll talk about that in the Miocene. In the Miocene, with the horses, what they have found is that they have the three-toed and the five-toed horses and the one-toed horses basically represented in the Miocene, and it didn't have anything to do with a sequence. They were living in different environments. It was environmentally controlled, apparently. We get our first hominids, and we get the glyptodons are common. Glyptodons, they find these in South America. These are really neat-looking animals. And there's the bald cypress swamp in Central Oregon. Swamp in Oregon, swampland up in Oregon. And, of course, then we move into the Pliocene. Now we're in the Neogene, and we're looking at Homo habilis. And then we have the issue of human evolution and when did man acquire the soul, which is what a lot of people struggle with. Certainly, many of my colleagues struggle with this particular issue as Christians. Was there a unique creation event? Does creation event really only address the creation of modern man with his concept of a soul? Some very unusual animals that, you know, it sort of looks like a deer or something, and then it's got this big horn coming out of its nose, which is rather bizarre. It looks out of place. And then when we move into the Quaternary with the Pleistocene, the Erectines, the modern humans, and the first mastodons, this is Homo erectus and the mastodons. Whoops, sorry about that. That's pretty blurry. And this is a reconstruction of the Ice Age period and the Holocene. 10,000 years to present. Cro-Magnon is older than that. It's like 30,000, but considered modern man. So what does the record tell us about origins? Are we looking at Darwinian evolution? Or are we even looking at some kind of punctuated equilibria type of approach here? Are we dealing with single stock that gradually changes and diversifies? Something that looks like this. Here's our little tree of life, as it spreads out and branches out and various organisms are originating or developing from single stock? Or does the fossil record actually look like this? I think it pretty much looks like this. We've got material in the Precambrian that, as a phyla, is extant. And then we've got phyla that originate in the Cambrian. Some has gone extinct. Others are extant. It's a very different picture, a picture of change, certainly, among the organisms, but not a picture of organisms developing from single stock. So here's our geologic column. We have our big eras on the left. We have that great fossil record. We have all the events that are going on, and the suggestion was made by Harold Clark of ecological zonation, that looking at ecological zonation, we could explain this order we see in the record, because there is that order from the simplest, the bacteria, into more complex organisms, into our marine organisms, which are many of them very complex, but from the marine then we move into the terrestrial organisms, the amphibians, the reptiles, through the dinosaurs and into the mammals. And we have a change in the plant populations as well. It's interesting that with the plant populations, their extinction events don't coincide very well at all with what's happening with the animals. So it's a bit of a puzzle for some. But it doesn't really explain it. He was looking at it like this, that we had these variety of environments and that these were basically sequentially destroyed. It's almost like an elevational zonation ecological system being destroyed. And in the big picture, certainly in the lower part of the record, the Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian are all marine. And if we're breaking up the fountains of the deep in the initial stages of the flood, it makes sense that the marine system is going to have a lot of destruction initially, and a lot of organisms are going to be rapidly buried and mineralized and preserved in the early stages of the flood, and then certainly as waters rise and things continue to happen. And so it looks in the big picture very well, but the truth is that in the detailed picture, it's absolutely lousy, because the flood is far more complex than that. To put it very simply, it's just much more complex than that. In addition, I think people need to be aware that the order in the record is not perfect. There's order in the record, but there are areas of conflict even there. So the picture is messy for everybody. My conclusions are that this is a record of death. There is no hope for us. Science does not offer us any hope. And I realize that many people, you know, believe that somehow humans will evolve into a higher state, we will move to a higher plane, but that is not really what the fossil record tells you. The fossil record tells you that you will go extinct, that humanity will go extinct, and something better or something different will replace us. That's what it tells us. And so there's no real hope in science. I think that's why the message of the Sabbath is so incredibly important. Because it says, hey folks, you didn't just develop from microorganisms. You haven't just been an accident. You're not even part of some guided process by some God who thought this was some kind of big joke. You're created by Him. You came from the hand of the Creator, and He's going to take care of you. He has provided for you so that you do have a future, and it's your choice. The sequence is real, but it's not perfect, and I think the ecological zones have limited use. So to conclude, oh Adam, this is such a perfect world. Yes, Eve, it's very good, just like God said. What kind of a world do we really believe in? I know that some have argued that Eden was all that God created, but to be created upon that mound of death, to me, is not a true picture of a loving God.
I think one of the key things that Elaine's work and several of our other scientists who still, you know, uphold a high view of Scripture, we're recognizing as we continue to look at science that the answers aren't always as easy as we used to think. That doesn't mean we capitulate and say we've got to, you know, go along with a naturalistic process of millions of years of evolution, but we have to continue to study. And the exciting thing for me is, as I talk to Elaine and some of my other colleagues, is that we're realizing we have to develop more sophisticated models. The answers aren't as easy as we thought, but there's not hopelessness out there. There's an awful lot of challenges going both directions, and that's what I find so exciting. The days when we used to, I remember growing up in Crater Roll, and basically the flood was the rain came down, the water got deep, and all the animals, you know, drowned. We recognize now, as we look at geology, that this event of the flood, this world catastrophe, and within the Hebrew of the flood account, it clearly is a universal event. It's not a local event. That's a different topic in a paper, but we're not giving that right now. But it was a major event, and we recognize as we look at this science that it was a very complicated event, way beyond what we used to previously understand. So we continue to move ahead with more sophisticated approaches, modeling, and so forth. I appreciate very much what you shared with us to kind of bring us up to date and to reflect. I think the bottom line is, can we be satisfied with the, you know, reign of death for millions of years, you know, that God used that process, and we see a lot of theological challenges there. Now, if you're interested in pursuing some of these ideas and their implications a little bit more, we're going to take a sort of a little dinner break or, you know, whatever you're going to do. I don't need to eat, I think, after our good midday meal. But we're going to come back for a final little get-together for those of you who can hang in there at 7 o'clock. We're going to have a little Vespers. Walter Booth, I guess, will make him our Vespers. He's going to share a brief presentation on the days of Genesis, or were they really literal days? And then our main conclusion feature will be really sort of a roundtable discussion. So you heard a lot of provocative things by Elaine, by Dr. Van Bimelen earlier, and several of the other presentations last night as well as this morning. So if you'd like to have a chance to dialogue, talk, discuss the implications, theological, scientific, philosophical, that'd be a chance to have a little bit of a round table. So we'd like to invite you back this evening. You head out the door at the conclusion of our presentation here. Dr. Dukan, who preached that wonderful sermon this morning, as I mentioned, I believe it was last night, is the editor of a special magazine called Shabbat Shalom. That's a Hebrew, the Hebrew greeting for having a happy, peaceful Sabbath. This particular issue that just came out is on creation. So if you're interested in getting a free copy of this, there won't be enough for every one of you, although he has quite a few, you can grab a copy of Shabbat Shalom. Look at these articles. I happen to have written one of them, but that was just coincidence. Number of great articles. Dr. Dukan has an article in here. I think Dr. Bob Johnson from the New Testament Department also has an article, if I recall. Several other good articles. So help yourself to one of these copies, and if later on you're interested in subscribing to some of the other good stuff in there, Dr. Dukan would be happy to hear from you. So with that, I think, was there a closing prayer organized, or I don't want to leave a portion out. Oh, I'm the closing prayer. Okay. Then, well, I'll say a word of prayer. We'll part. And then if you have a little bit of time to come back in about an hour and a half, we'll meet just one more time here and have a little bit of discussion. And that will close our symposium. Shall we bow our heads? Dear Father in heaven, we thank you for the diligent study of the presenters that we heard last night, this morning, and this afternoon. It stimulates our thinking. It helps us recognize how grand you are. How magnificent the creation is, how complicated it is, and the challenges that are there to keep us occupied and pondering your great works, Lord. We pray that you'll be with us now as we approach the closing hours of this Sabbath. We thank you for your promise to be with us. We thank you for the spiritual fellowship that we have enjoyed. And we pray, Lord, that you will keep us safe and be with us as we continue our evening's activities in a short amount of time. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
This special presentation has been brought to you by American Cassette Ministries. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2000, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. For additional cassettes by this speaker or for a free catalog of other American Cassette Ministry cassettes, please contact us as follows. To order toll-free in the United States and Canada, dial 1-800-233-4450. For international calls, dial 717-652-7000. For fax orders, dial 1-717-652-9050. Our internet email address is info@americancassette.org. Our entire current catalog, plus many other items, are available online from our secure website, www.americancassette.org. We accept MasterCard, Visa, and Discover cards. Or you may simply write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17108, in the United States of America. Answering the heart cry of the faithful for 25 years, American Cassette Ministries requests your continued prayers and financial support as we strive to provide you with the finest, most powerful spiritual messages available. Our one purpose in ministry, to prepare you and your loved ones to meet Jesus Christ. Peace coming soon.